The New York Times reported last week that interrogation methods introduced after the 9/11 attacks were actually torture methods believed to have been used by the Soviet Union. Tony Lagaranis served in the Army from May 2001 until July 2005 and was one of the Army interrogators who used those methods in Abu Ghraib and other detention centers in Iraq. His book, Fear Up Harsh, An Army Interrogator's Dark Journey Through Iraq, is his account of his part in the prisoner abuses that shocked people around the world and how he views his role in the war now. It's published by the New American Library, and it brings Tony Lagaranis to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
When you joined the Army before the September 11th attacks, what were you hoping that military life would hold for you?
Really, what I was looking for was to learn Arabic, and the Army promised to teach me Arabic, which they did, and they also promised to repay my student loans, which they partly did.
Why Arabic?
I'd studied Hebrew before and became interested in the Semitic languages. I tried to learn Arabic on my own, and it proved to be too difficult.
Was it your intention to become an Army interrogator using that Arabic?
No, I didn't care what job the Army gave me. I went into the recruiter, said I wanted to learn Arabic, and there were two jobs that I could get. One was a signal intercept and the other interrogator. A signal intercept required a security clearance that would have been too difficult for me to get.
But you say you were outraged that the 9/11 attacks were being used to justify the invasion of Iraq. How do you go from there to becoming part of one of the darker aspects of the war?
Well, as I was going into Iraq, it was after the invasion. So I really believed in the mission of shutting down the insurgency and certainly saving American soldiers' lives. And, while I didn't share George Bush's vision of a democratic and capitalistic Iraq, I believed in what I saw my mission to be, which would be to save lives.
And were they training you to be an Army interrogator?
They trained me at Fort Huachuca in 2001, and we had about a two-month course in interrogation.
You were given lectures on the Arab mind. What sorts of things did they tell you about the Arab mind?
They drew all their cultural studies about Arabs from primarily one book. It's called The Arab Mind by George Bataille, and it's a fairly racist document.
George Bataille, the French novelist?
No. I'm not sure what else he's done, but in the book, he talks about cultural things about Arabs that are fairly benign. For instance, always ask an Arab about his family before you get down to business, exchange pleasantries. Those things are, generally true, but they also have things in there like Arabs can't think logically, Arabs don't have the same relation to truth that we do, meaning that they're liars. Arabs can't think linearly in time like we do. These things are obviously racist.
And must be odd there. There had to be some Arabs in the military. I don't know whether any of them were in your unit or in those classes, but some people had to think that was rather ridiculous.
Well, I certainly thought that was ridiculous. I'd had plenty of contacts with Arabs before I joined the military, and I didn't believe a word of it, and many of us were smarter than that. And I think the Arabs in the military, they heard that kind of thing all the time anyway.
Were you one? Were there other people in your regiment who could speak Arabic?
Yes. A number of us went through the language school together and were deployed to Iraq together.
When you first arrived at the Abu Ghraib prison, one of the first things you learned was that something bad happened there, as you put it. What did you learn? When did you learn about the prisoner abuses by U.S. military personnel and about the sexual humiliation techniques and all the other things that wound up shocking the world?
We weren't allowed to talk about it or ask about what had happened.
How long after?
We didn't learn about it until you learned about it on CNN, mm-hmm. Honestly. I mean, my friends were at Abu Ghraib for 6 months before they figured out what had gone on.
So you were there already, but you knew something had gone on because you heard rumors?
We were given an official briefing by a colonel the day we arrived, and he told us that something bad had happened. He instructed us not to talk about it or ask about it, but he said there's going to be a scandal. So be prepared.
And had the abuses been stopped by that time?
for the most part, they'd really begun cleaning up Abu Ghraib. We were a brand new interrogation unit. There was a brand new MP unit, and the practices and of interrogation had been cleaned up.
What was your reaction and the reaction of others you were with to seeing those photos?
Well, it was funny because by that time I had moved out of Abu Ghraib and I was in other detention facilities that were using very harsh methods that are reflected in the photos. However,
that was Al-Assad and
Mosul.
Still,
what I saw shocked me because the things that we were doing weren't sexual in nature, and the first pictures that came out were primarily sexual in nature. And so I saw what they were doing at Abu Ghraib as abhorrent, even though I hadn't quite come to that point. I certainly had moral problems with what I was doing and had questioned it, but I hadn't come to the point of fully realizing the depth of the crimes that I was committing.
Given your lack of training in terms of interrogation techniques, how did you approach your first interrogations?
Our first interrogations we would do with another interrogator who was more experienced, who had been there for a long time. And so we were picking up cues from them and how to behave and how to act. I remember my first interrogations, I was simply nervous and felt like the detainee could see that I was probably inexperienced. The man was older than I was. He was one of Saddam Hussein's bodyguards. He was an intimidating fellow, and I was eager to gain control over that situation and assert myself as the dominant one in the room.
The title of your book is Fear Up Harsh. Is that one of the techniques that you learned? I'm not even sure what Fear Up Harsh would mean.
Fear Up Harsh is a technique that was sanctioned by the Army even before 9/11, and it's in conformity with Geneva Conventions as I understand it. It's the harshest method that an interrogator has in his toolbook, and it simply involves, you know, raising your voice, yelling at the detainee, maybe pounding your fist or throwing a chair or something, but there's no threat implied, there's no explicit threat, and you're not allowed to touch the detainee.
Does it help when you speak Arabic? Because I'm sure some of the interrogators were working through translators, and that just eats up a lot of time and also perhaps can lead to some confusion.
Well, honestly, even though I studied Arabic for a year and a third, we learned a standard Arabic, which is very literary. They don't speak that in Iraq. I didn't understand Iraqi Arabic.
And did you ever come to understand
it? I came to be able to understand it well, and I could conduct an interrogation in Arabic by the time I left, but I preferred to use an interpreter. Arabic helped a lot, though, to like control the interpreter and really understand what was going on.
Is there such a thing as a good interrogation?
Absolutely, yeah. There are very good interrogators out there. I saw very few good interrogations in Iraq, but I know that there are talented interrogators.
Well, how would a good interrogation work? What would you hope to achieve?
Well, your goal always is to gain actionable intelligence, something that a commander can use in the field. But what a good interrogator does is manipulate the prisoner. And you don't do that by violence or cruelty. You do that in all kinds of ways, and they teach us different approaches that sound really benign, that you couldn't imagine why they'd work. But a good interrogator uses these in combination and manipulates them.
Well, it sounds like some of the things you were told during those stupid lectures on the Arab mind might be the best way to go about it. Become a friend to some degree of the person you're interrogating, or would they see right through that?
No. A good interrogator will do that seamlessly. You know, a charismatic person, somebody who fits a role that the detainee wants to open up to. A good interrogator is somebody who the detainee wants to please, and the interrogator fulfills a need in him.
You describe how you felt uncomfortable and that you might be crossing a line in the early interrogations that you were involved with, and yet you continued to cross that line. What do you think that was?
Well, part of it was fear. We were afraid that we were getting shot at all the time in Iraq, and we wanted that intelligence. We were also simply frustrated at our own failure, and it was also a desire to, again, as I said, assert dominance over a person that, you know, we felt we should have control over. They were our prisoner. but they were defying us by not telling us what we wanted to hear.
Did you get the information that you were looking for ever?
Very, very rarely. If we got any information that was worth anything in the interrogation booth, we would put up an interrogation report. I don't remember how many I put up all year, but it was less than a dozen, and I did between 300 and 400 interrogations during that year.
Well, if I were running a company which had such a low success record, I might question the techniques of my salespeople.
Right. Well,
were they asking you whether were they trying to make suggestions on how you might change things and be more effective, or did they just simply feel that this was the way things are?
Well, they did that in a number of ways. They tried to improve it in a number of ways. One of them was to bring in an Army psychiatrist and have him go into the interrogation booth with us or go over our interrogation plans and try and devise ways to get inside the prisoner.
Did they give you good advice?
No. In fact, I did a few interrogations with this psychiatrist, and he had no success at all. You know, as medically unsound as that, as an interrogation practice, it's probably not a bad idea to have some psychological knowledge. But the main way that people tried to get more intelligence or improve our methods was to get more aggressive in the interrogation booth and to introduce more torture methods.
And Firip Harsh, as your book's title suggests. Firip Harsh, An Army Interrogator's Dark Journey Through Iraq, written by Tony Lagaranis with the help of Alan McKillian and published by New American Library, Caliber. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Tony Lagaranis, Lagouranis, who has written with the help of Alan McKillian the book Firip Harsh, An Army Interrogator's Dark Journey Through Iraq. It's published by New American Library. And a listener informs us that the reason we were confused about the Arab Bind is it was written by Raphael Patai, P-A-T-A-I, an anthropologist, not Georges Bataille, the famous French novelist, which confused me a bit. Once you had finished interrogating these prisoners, what happened to them? Were they just returned to their cells to be brought back the next day for more of the same?
Usually, yes. But ultimately, what happened to them differed unit by unit. Often, if we decided that they were innocent, we would try to get them out of the prison. That was very difficult often. Usually the detaining units wanted them to be guilty, no matter what we said, no matter how much evidence or lack of it they had, and they would often get sent to Abu Ghraib and just rot there.
Because it would be an admission of some kind of a mistake to
exactly.
Say that they had just picked up an innocent person. Were prisoners who appeared to be cooperative or had been cooperative treated differently from the ones who refused to provide any information?
Actually, providing information was a detriment to the future of that detainee, because it was assumed that if he gave information that he was involved in the insurgency, whether there
damned
was
if you do, damned if you don't.
Exactly, right. And so he would get sent in for further interrogations and would certainly never be let out of Abu Ghraib.
You report in your book that the interrogation rules of engagement kept shifting while you were in Abu Ghraib. With hindsight, why do you think that was?
Well, at Abu Ghraib, things were getting cleaner. They were backing away from the harsh interrogation tactics during the year, and that was a direct result of the scandal. However, in the other detention facilities where there wasn't such a spotlight, we continued to use harsh tactics up until well after the scandal.
And you did torture someone, Khalid, while you were in Mosul. What did you do to him?
That particular case, we were using a combination of military working dogs. We had him in a shipping container with loud music and strobe lights to overload his senses. He was subjected to hypothermia, stress positions, isolation, and sleep deprivation.
Now, how did you come up with that? Somebody must have suggested some of those things.
many of those, well, actually all of those things came from a document issued by the Pentagon saying that these techniques were legal. And we worked from that document.
Have they continued to be considered legal?
I'm not sure. And frankly, I'm not even sure if all of those techniques were legal, appropriate for that time and place. We might have been using a document that was issued by Guantanamo, but it was a document that was given to us by the unit up there.
So the implication is that these kinds of techniques are being used at Guantanamo, where the standards are a little different?
From what I heard, and I don't know this for a fact, the standards at Guantanamo are much more lenient, so they can use harsher tactics than we were allowed to in the field.
Were you horrified by what you had done? Is that why you stopped doing them?
Yeah. Over the course of the year, I completely backed away from those things. And I don't think I fully realized my own culpability in it, even though I was disgusted by the practices until later.
Well, some of these things are really cruel. When you say stress positions, you're talking about putting people in position where it's hard to stand or where their hands are tied above their heads and they're kept up even though they want to go to sleep?
Yeah, those are very creative methods that some people use. We tended to just make them kneel for long, long periods of time.
Some people say that what happens is little by little you slip into this sort of thing and you don't realize that you're doing things that you never would have done at any other time in your life, but there's almost a sadistic pleasure in them, isn't there?
Yeah, part of it was a sadistic pleasure, and part of it was that everyone around us seemed to think it was okay, and you sort of drift as a group morally, and you lose perspective. And part of that perspective came back when I saw how shocked people were in the United States over some of the same techniques that I happened to be using, and it snapped me back into a broader context.
Didn't you report what had happened to the Criminal Investigation Division?
I did. Right after I was returning from Mosul to Abu Ghraib, Mosul's where I did the harshest stuff, I went to Criminal Investigations and I told them everything that I had done, everything that I had seen others that they had done, and I continued to report to CID throughout my year there and even after I returned.
And what happened to your reports?
Well, I reported to CID three times before I got out of the Army. Then after I got out of the Army, I appeared on Frontline and made some allegations about torture. And CID called me up after that interview, and they said, "We watched your Frontline piece. Why didn't you report to us any of these things that you saw?" I said, "I did. I reported to you many times." And he said, "No, we ran your name through the computer, and we didn't find a single report." So, and I reported also up through the Marine chain of command, and I issued a report through my Army chain of command at Abu Ghraib, and I don't know what happened to most of those.
Well, do you think it's likely that it's just accidental that all of these reports were lost or misfiled or whatever happened to them?
Or deleted? There certainly is incompetence in the military, so that's possible, but that all of these things would have disappeared is highly unlikely.
My guest is Tony Lagaranis, who's written Fear Up Harsh, an Army Interrogator's Dark Journey Through Iraq with the help of Alan McCallion. Well, in his book, Torture and Truth, Mark Danner concludes that the real scandal is political. He says it's not about revelation or disclosure, but about the failure once wrongdoing is disclosed of politicians, officials, the press, and ultimately citizens to act. Having been in the midst of all of this and as a citizen who failed to act, how do you think this kind of thing can be prevented?
Well, I think it's easily prevented. It should come from the leadership. I don't think the military asked for permission from the Pentagon to torture. I think the Pentagon told the military that these are now the rules, or we're going to.
When you say the Pentagon, are you talking about the Secretary of Defense, or are you talking about some top generals?
I couldn't say who it is, but clearly that interrogation rules of engagement that we got came from the Pentagon, and it didn't come, or perhaps CENTCOM, and it didn't come from the military itself. So the military was taking its orders from the civilian leadership, and that's where I put the real blame, is the civilian leadership.
Weren't you discharged from the Army for health reasons? What were the health reasons?
I came back from Iraq, and I was feeling overwhelming guilt as well as just anxiety. I was having insomnia. I was having bad dreams. I had a couple of panic attacks. And after a bad panic attack, I brought myself into the emergency room and started getting treatment. And the Army discharged me medically.
Well, in many cases, post-traumatic stress disorder is just ignored or dismissed. They took yours seriously because of the kind of work you'd done?
That was part of it. I mean, I did not only what I told you about the torture techniques, but I also I had a detail of going through dead bodies for a month in Fallujah, and I mean that was pretty traumatic. But I was never diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. I should be clear about that.
But it sounds like some form of it.
Perhaps, yeah. Part of the reason that they got me out of the military, I believe, is that I was being very insubordinate when I got back too, and I was angry at the Army for what they had asked me to do and the way that they had failed us.
And that's when you decided to go to the media?
Right, yeah. As soon as I was discharged from the Army, I went straight to a friend who had an NPR station in San Francisco.
At that time, you were the only Army interrogator willing to talk about what happened. Did that get you into further trouble?
It didn't. I mean, the Army tried to slander me and call me a liar, as well as the Marines. But they never tried to prosecute me or come after me.
That you did give them this book to go through, didn't you?
I did, but not for content, only for classified material, to make sure that there was no classified material in the book. They went through it. They approved it without any changes.
You said that few interviewers have wanted to address your own abuse of detainees directly. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. Maybe they consider it an incredibly impolite or difficult thing to.
But since you're a witness to this, you're the person you have to ask, isn't it true?
Sure. Yeah. I also witnessed other abuses that I didn't commit, and I think it was easier for them to talk about that.
Have people you've told this to had different kinds of reactions, judgmental reactions? We got an email from a listener who says, your guest is speaking about how he did many things that he was uncomfortable with while interrogating prisoners. I was wondering if he's planning on donating some of the proceeds from his new book to a group such as Amnesty International to help prevent these incidents in the future.
Well, that would be a nice gesture, but frankly, all the proceeds I got came as in the form of an advance that I used to write the book. I was working on this for 2 years, and I didn't really have another full-time job. However, I do plan to I'm trying to work for Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch as soon as I'm done with this book tour.
Some people say that there is an atmosphere out there that also allows this sort of thing. Would you agree with some, even some within the Army, who say that TV programs like 24 bear some responsibility for the climate that allows for the mistreatment of suspects and detainees?
I certainly think so. I mean, not only did I see interrogators, because we were working in an area where we weren't trained. We were trained according to Geneva, and now we were being asked to be creative and torture people. So we turned to the only source we had for that, which was television programs. And people were watching DVDs and cable TV out there and taking posturing like the interrogators they saw on television. But in addition to that, and I think a bigger problem, is that whenever I talk about torture since I've gotten back, supporters of torture always bring up 24. They always bring up the ticking time bomb scenario, which, you know, any interrogator will tell you that particular scenario is ridiculous. It's impossible. And 24 depicts torture as being effective, and I really take issue with that. I don't believe it's effective at all.
Well, if a person has a ticking time bomb and is committed to a cause, might very well lie about it and be willing to be punished as a martyr for that cause.
That's right. I mean, if you think about it, this is a person who's willing to kill other innocent people, and he's willing to die for his cause. He's not gonna just give it up if you torture him. In addition to that, if he knows that the bomb's going to go off in the 8 hours because it's a ticking time bomb, he knows how long he has to withstand whatever torture you're going to inflict on him.
The Geneva Convention regarding the treatment of prisoners of war was formulated as a reaction to conventional warfare, and people who defend the use of torture, the vice president was supported. What is that thing where you nearly drown somebody?
The waterboarding.
Waterboarding. He and others say, well, you know, the rules are different now because this is a different kind of a war.
Well, think about it. In World War II, if we had tortured detainees, we could have gotten information that would have saved lives, many lives. I mean, if torture were effective, if we could have gotten information by any means from them, we could have saved many lives. How is it different today in an unconventional warfare? So if it's a moral principle in World War II that torture is immoral and it's not something a civilized nation does, I don't see how it's different today. It's still immoral.
The only Republican candidate who's come out against torture is John McCain, and that's because he's had experience with it firsthand, I suspect, as a victim of torture. General David Petraeus, the top commander in Iraq, sent a letter to troops this month warning that using force in interrogations violates American values. Do you think this is an indication that there's a fresh wind blowing in the Army's approach to obtaining intelligence?
Well, I think that, as I said, I don't think that the willingness or desire to torture came from the military in the first place. So I think what you're seeing there is the military asserting itself against the civilian leadership. And it's interesting, I'd like to mention, you know, you said John McCain himself had personal experience with this, and he's the only one coming out against torture. Why is it that the people who know what torture is, who know what interrogation is, say that it doesn't work? The CIA did studies on torture. They said torture doesn't work. The Army, who's been interrogating people since the Revolutionary War, says torture doesn't work. The FBI doesn't torture people. So it's only the people who are inexperienced and who are these civilians, they want to torture people.
By the way, a retired Marine just called and thanked you for having the courage to say what you did. He's a 20-year veteran. The book is Fear Up Harsh and Army Interrogator's Dark Journey Through Iraq, written by Tony Lagaranis with the help of Alan McKellian and published by New American Library. Tony, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
On tomorrow's show, two paleontologists tell us about bringing dinosaurs to life. And then an on-air barbecue taste test with restaurateur Danny Meyer and food writers Matt and Ted Lee. Also a look at a newly restored documentary about Chet Baker. Plus, this week's Please Explain focuses on Alzheimer's. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Tanya Wiedeking. Debbie Darcy was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.